Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to another newly recorded episode of Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And I'm going to be joined today by Charles Lewis, founding director of the Center for Public Integrity. His last book was 935 Lies, The Future of Truth and the Decline of America's Moral Integrity, published at least a year before Donald Trump descended that escalator to the White House. And you can learn more at charles-lewis.com and publicintegrity.org. But first, after hosting and producing the show for nearly two decades, in 2014, I stopped recording new live interviews, and the show has continued on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, streaming relevant interviews from the archives, podcasts available anytime, anywhere on iTunes, Podomatic.com, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, to the same site. But with the election of Donald Trump, I could not resist exploring the path forward in new interviews, and this is the 26th such interview. I've included Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on her book No Is Not Enough, David K. Johnston on the daily dirty work of the Trump administration, and they're all available on my website, TerrenceMcNally.net, or at iTunes. First, also, let me offer you a few websites for information on how to participate in resistance to Trump and the movement toward the healthy and just future that we need. Indivisibleguide.com, that's probably the most extensive, most thriving sort of resistance. I think there are like 5,000 local groups. Indivisibleguide.com. OurRevolution.com, the organization that grew out of the Bernie Sanders campaign. MoveOn.org, been around for years doing mostly digital, now coordinates its digital activism more closely with grassroots organizing. CourageCampaign.org, similar to Move On, but focused on the state of California and its resistance. And then two specific ones, Five Calls, that's the number five in the word calls, fivecalls.org, which tells you the calls that are most timely and relevant that you might make to your representatives about issues that are, you know, happening right then, and townhallproject.com, which tells you when your representatives or nearby representatives are going to be holding town hall, so you can show up and, you know, let them know how you feel and what you think. And you can email me at T.E. McNally, T.E. McNally, at mac.com if you want more information. Now to today's guest. Charles Lewis left 60 Minutes because he was unwilling to compromise as much as that hugely successful program needed him to in his investigative journalism. He then founded the Center for Public Integrity to create a place where commercial considerations would have no place. He titled his 2014 book 935 Lies because that was the number of untruths the Bush-Cheney administration used in the 2 years following September 11th to justify the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Now, when my 23-year-old stepson asked me the other day what I was reading, I realized that the title, which likely employed the number because it seemed so outrageous at the time, so damning, now feels almost quaint. As we know, journalists calculated that Donald Trump told at least 2,000 lies during his first year in office. And as we all know, Trump's taken lying to an unprecedented and hardly imaginable level. But so much of what Charles Lewis was writing about in the book described the conditions that welcomed Trump, the conditions that made Trump possible. Some aspects of the sophisticated use of social media, data on the data or the Russian meddling were not mentioned in the book, and perhaps they were not fully anticipated or even understood at the time. But things were plenty bad already. 935 Lies opens with the sad report that, according to polls at the end of 2004, more than half of all Americans believe there had been weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And Lewis writes, quote, "If facts no longer matter to millions of our fellow citizens, then what becomes of the traditional role of the journalist as the independent watchdog digging through obfuscation, secrecy, and deception by the powerful in search of what Carl Bernstein of the Watergate press work once called the best obtainable version of the truth?" And Lewis quotes George Orwell, "Political speech and writing are largely to the defense of the indefensible. Political language is designed to make lies sound truthful and murder respectable and to give an appearance of solidity to pure wind." And finally, he quotes Hannah Arendt, quote, "The result of a consistent and total substitution of lies for factual truth is not that the lies will now be accepted as truth and the truth be defamed as lies, but that the sense by which we take our bearings in the real world and the category of truth versus falsehood is among the mental means to this end is being destroyed. The stakes are high. Charles Lewis is a former ABC News and CBS News 60 Minutes producer, a best-selling author, and the founder of two Pulitzer Prize-winning nonprofit news organizations, the Center for Public Integrity and the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. A MacArthur Fellow, he's the founding executive editor of the Investigative Reporting Workshop, a professor at American University in Washington, and as I said, his most recent book is 935 Lies, The Future of Truth and the Decline of America's Moral Integrity. Welcome, Charles Lewis, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Oh, thanks. Thanks very much for having me.
Okay. I like listeners to get a feel for the people. We've got time. We do an hour here for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. How would you tell the story of your path to the work that you're doing these days? I know.
How much time do you have? Not just Well, it's, you know, life always takes odd turns, right, for everyone in this world. And I didn't set out to be a pain in the ass. It just apparently is what happened. I was a Boy Scout. I was an Eagle Scout. I was head of my Boy Scout troop. I was president of my class, president of my school. And I believed in, you know, all the things that are in the Pledge of Allegiance and all that stuff. My family, both sides, my mother and my father, go back to the 1700s. So I was a pretty straight arrow and thought what I was told all the time by those in authority generally probably was true to some extent. I mean, certainly as a child, I mean, you know, in the earliest years. But then, you know, we came to the Vietnam War and Watergate and all these other things that happened in life. And I began, and I think my epiphany really was, it was the assassinations of several of our leaders in the late 60s combined with Watergate, which was a different kind of tragedy, but systemic tragedy, really, regarding democracy. And then I found myself years later working for ABC News and 60 Minutes and actually working for Carl Bernstein just 3 years after the president resigned, or I guess it was 5 years after, at ABC News in Washington. So I've been on a very strange odyssey, and I went to 60 Minutes, and that was exciting to be there. I was proud to be there, of course, and I worked with Mike Wallace, the lead investigative correspondent and tenacious interviewer, classically. I mean, there's no more tenacious interviewer that I think has ever lived in the last half century, but also a difficult guy to work for. But mm-hmm. I ended up quitting 60 Minutes because one of my stories was they took someone's name out for reasons unrelated to journalism, and I didn't like it one bit. And it wasn't the first time I'd had a story spiked or blocked or altered for non-journalism reasons. And so I quit and started the center. So a lot of this was me reacting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was not proactive. It was mostly seeing things that were upsetting and shocking and deciding it seemed wrong. You know, and I know that sounds strange, but that's it wasn't anything I could have ever imagined. I mean, I thought I would go into politics, to be honest with you. When I was a sports writer at the local paper, they called me an embryonic politician. I believed in all these things, and then I started to see that what you see is not what you get, and suddenly things looked a lot different. And then I started finding it interesting why that is, and one thing led to another.
How did you first become an investigative reporter?
Well, when I was hired at ABC, that's a really interesting question because I had never done news reporting. When I was hired at age 23, 600 applicants, six positions for a special reporting unit set up by Rune Arledge after he had become president of ABC News in addition to ABC Sports, I was the last person hired, and I had gotten a rejection letter because there were 600 applicants, and you know, I didn't really have any news reporting experience. I had a master's degree, that helped, but it so happened one of my references was a secret source in the Kennedy White House leaking to the guy who hired me, Sander Van Oker, a very famous in the 60s and 70s White House correspondent who was with both Kennedys when they were shot. I didn't know any of that. I just knew that I was an earnest fellow, and I started befriending the secretary, and I wheedled my way into a meeting with Sander Van Oker, and I was very over-caffeinated, and I got hired. I don't know how else to put it. It's pretty funny, though. I mean, I'm very lucky. I feel like Forrest Gump sometimes.
I must tell you, Charles, and you probably know this, but, you know, I've been doing this show for many years, and I ask that question about people's path very often, and It is remarkable in a way how often the very successful folks, the folks that we know their achievements, it's all this sort of accidental, coincidental, serendipitous, you know, et cetera, that although they tell you to set goals and pursue them, it turns out that most people's path winds much more than that.
Yeah, the old Beatles song, The Long and Winding Road. I mean, you don't see any of this coming, but we all live across the board. Everyone lives by their wits and their how they interpret and react to things when they happen. And sometimes we're all human and we make mistakes too, so I'm not trying to make it sound like it's a perfect thing to do, but I apparently had certain things underneath that were, you know, kind of solid, and I wasn't budging, and I guess there's a stubbornness somewhere. I know no one ever told me that I was stubborn, but I think maybe I was. But the bottom line is, you know, as I'm not a spring chicken now. I look back, and I realize this has been a very peculiar journey. There's no other way to put it.
And this moment when you resigned from 60 Minutes, you'd been there 5 years. Just for people who, rather than just dealing with that one specific incident that happened before, you know, 60 Minutes is an institution, an icon, all of those things. What was it like? What worked for you at 60 Minutes and what didn't work? Just to give people a little feeling what goes on behind the scenes.
Yeah, no, it was, I want to say, it was a thrill and an honor, or as I wrote when Mike Wallace died, an honor and a privilege to work there. I'm proud that I worked there. Well, it was, you know, we know it's the number one news show in American history. It's been in the top 10 shows. I believe it's still in the top 10. It's in its 50th year.
Yeah.
1976 on, it was in the top 10. That's shocking by any measure. A news program, no less. And, you know, I got to know Don Hewitt, who was the founder. And he was patterning the show after Life magazine, and he said, we don't do stories about issues, we do stories about people. And you had to, everything was either if it was investigative or something like that, it was a morality tale, or it was profiling celebrities or whatever. But three segments, he would mix up and combine the segments. It was only the person who did that was Don Hewitt, the founder, and there's been a subsequent executive director since. But the bottom line is a very simple formula, but not so simple. You might interview 30, 40, 50 people, but you can't put more than five on camera because the public gets distracted by that. And you only have 12, 13, 14 minutes in your segment when you add in all the things around the show, and the front and the back, and commercials. And so you end up, you know, you look for good characters. That was a phrase that when I went to 60 Minutes, I'd already been at ABC 6.5 years. We never used the word characters. We just covered whatever was happening in a kind of a flat-footed way. I mean, the way all TV media mostly covers stuff. But this was about character development, finding voices that were strong, and, you know, and even stuff like the visual appearance was relevant. Obviously, if they had a horrific case of acne and a scar in their left cheek, you weren't going to shoot him up tight on national television.
You know? Their story couldn't make up for it unless that was the story.
Yeah, exactly. So you had, those were all things that I had never experienced and I was fascinated by, and they would get 3,000 to 4,000 letters a year urging certain subjects be covered, and that you'd end up, there would be 100 segments, I mean, 100 shows, I guess, a year. And each producer had to do, at that time, 4 segments, and for investigative, that's a bear. That's really hard to do. That means you're investigating, you're traveling and filming across the U.S. or outside the U.S. You have 1 month to report and film, 1 month to, well, I guess 1 month to research, one to film it, and one to edit it. And editing would always be a bear because you've got to whittle down hundreds of minutes down to 13 minutes.
By the way, one thing that's interesting is I hadn't heard that quote from Hewitt before. We don't do stories about issues. We do stories about people. But as soon as I read it in your book, it became so clear to me that that is exactly what they do. You look at my wife calls it the tick, tick, tick. When we, and you know, you want to watch the tick, we always watch the tick, 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 and then decide whether we watch it right then or later. No matter what the issue, it always seems to find people at the center. And by the way, Michael Lewis, probably the most successful, right at the top of nonfiction writing.
Yeah.
I've interviewed him several times. Absolutely the same formula. Until he finds the characters, all the financial information he's figured out about The Big Short doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, I mean, he's right. And I was never focused deeply personally. I was not an English major. I didn't ever focus on character and all characters. You know, all that stuff was not, I have two political science degrees. That's not something that ever occurred to me.
Right.
Be very
right.
candid. So, but it's absolutely essential. And it's, you know, Hewitt came into CBS in the late 40s and, he saw Murrow with See It Now and some of the shows he was doing. There was a celebrity show that Edward R. Murrow did.
Person to Person.
Not as august. Yeah, that's right, Person to Person. And he knew how those things had been constructed, and he understood the importance of celebrity and characters that are interesting. That's where he really got that, I think.
Yeah, and what's impressive, I mean, obviously, and Hewitt was at the helm for most of the 50 years, but
yeah,
but
was.
that not, you know, to have the right formula is, you know, that's one thing, but to keep it up for as long as they have is what's most impressive, and especially as we notice now, they kept an awful lot of the lead personalities on until they, in Bob Simon's case, died, you know, with their boots on,
yeah.
Sort of. And right now we're seeing, I think, for the first time in the last couple of years, some new faces. It's an interesting moment at 60 Minutes. So you leave that. People tell you you're crazy, but you realize you're at least stubborn, if not crazy. And why the Center for Public Integrity?
Well, you know, I had stories also blocked at the two networks and in general, and I knew there were a lot of systematic stories that weren't covered. And I was furious at all the stories the Washington Press Corps had missed. The savings and loan story, big scandal, biggest financial scandal at that time since the Depression. Most journalists missed that, except local journals throughout the U.S., like in the Southwest and Phoenix and Texas and stuff. And there were several other major scandals, the HUD scandal, Housing and Urban Development,
right,
where
right.
there's a lot of cronyism. All these scandals were broken by government reports that came out, or in the case of Iran-Contra, the first story was in the Middle East in Israel. No one in the Washington Press Corps seemed to even be fazed or embarrassed by that. I thought it was humiliation that they were all asleep, basically. And it was only 10 years after Watergate, but it felt like they were coasting or complacent or something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I didn't like the arrogance. I'm an old-fashioned guy, and I don't like people to think they're, you know, hot, fill in the blank there. And it offends me, actually. And a lot of the press corps, and I'd, you know, been in it myself, but from a TV standpoint, which is somewhere downstream from the august
yes.
newspapers that we can imagine what they are.
Yes.
I had an attitude, I guess you'd say, after quitting 60. And also, let's be frank, I wouldn't be hard. I was a TV person, and that's how they saw me. So no one knows what a producer does anyway, most people, including print journalists. And so the idea of me going to the print world was, even though I knew I had met some of the many of the folks, including the Ben Bradleys of the world, but I had never applied, and I didn't have any, very many at least, print clips, you know, newspaper clips. And so the options were pretty limited. So part of this was survival.
Yeah,
I didn't want to,
yeah.
The last thing in the world that I would ever do, and I can imagine doing it, and I was terrified I might have to do financially because I was married and had a small child and a mortgage. I did not want to work for public relations, good Lord. And the only thing I could, and I didn't want to be an advocate for some NGO just because I still saw myself as an investigative journalist, and I felt that I had been a cog in a very large wheel, a TV network with thousands of people that was generally unknown outside the network, networks, plural, the two I worked at. And so I decided the only way to do this would be create my own thing. I always also wanted to do deep dive investigations. And our early mantras that we were combining political science or, you know, deep research of an unlikely or unusual type of research with journalism, investigative journalism. We'd pull a lot of our material was based on records, and we would take 5 or 10 data sets, different sets of primary records, and cross-mesh them. Most journalists are now forced to do 2 or 3 stories a day. You know what I mean? No one has time to go through records like that.
Yeah, this sounds a little bit like what I.F. Stone was doing.
Well, yeah, he's certainly one of my heroes. He was. And he was one of my heroes. There are several people of my heroes. And, of course, the classic Woodward and Bernstein after Watergate still, there was an afterglow from that. And But I was seen as suspicious even by the Post. One of the my boss, Sander Van Oker at ABC, wanted me. They thought I belonged in print, and the number two guy was head of Huntley Brinkley for years, and it was this number two to Van Oker in the special reporting unit. And they put me in touch with Ben Bradley, and I went to the Post and I talked to Woodward. But to them, they said, "Why would we hire some guy who's doing TV stuff inside ABC when we can get a 10-year veteran of the Chicago Tribune?" At that time, they had thousands of applicants right after Watergate, can imagine.
Sure.
So, in a way, I'm very fortunate because roads that I might have thought of taking, I couldn't take, and I had no choice but to improvise, I guess you'd say.
Yeah, and this notion of a nonprofit investigative journalism, investigative reporting center, this was pretty original at that point. Now, one thing that I learned in your book also was I didn't realize that the Associated Press is a nonprofit.
Yeah, it is. There are a lot of nonprofits. Christian Science Monitor is owned by a church. It's
and
a
the Guardian, right?
Yeah, the Guardian in England has a trust. That's right. A lot of these groups. There is a long history of nonprofit things. And then you have high-quality journalism. That admittedly, these other ones we just said are not funded by government. You also have National Public Radio, which really does a pretty premier job, I think, of news gathering in general in the U.S. and around the world. It's pretty, I mean, not investigative reporting as much, but as just down the middle straight news headlines and insightful stories. And that is a nonprofit, essentially.
Yep. Yep.
That gets some government funding, as does, of course, Frontline. I work with Frontline closely now because they co-produce with my investigative reporting workshop in our building, actually.
Uh-huh.
But those are all collaborations that are magnificent. But, there's a way to do these things now, but you have to be creative, I guess we'd say.
Yeah. And you sort of told us the sense of what the Center for Public Integrity does, which is that it looks at data, it looks deeply, it takes time, it spends money, and so on, working. So tell, just for one example, your first story and the consequences of it.
It was fun. It is fun investigating the bastards, whoever they are, I have to say. It's like, you can't believe that this is a real job. My last story, 60 Minutes, was about White House trade officials going to work Friday for the U.S., Monday working for Japan. Back then, that was a big deal because the biggest trade deficit then was with Japan. And, making $500,000 or $1 million instead of $100,000,
right,
et cetera. And so I did. I had 12 people in one in the Dukakis campaign and 7 or 8 in the Bush campaign, or vice versa. I guess Bush had more. And they were all registered foreign agents who had cashed in and quintupled or higher their salary. And I was offended by it. So that led the show was nominated for an Emmy, and the next morning I resigned and broke a 4-year contract. But the idea was to look at documents. So we did a report called America's Frontline Trade Officials, close to 200 pages, and I had a little team of 7 or 8 interns and mostly young, very extremely young people helping me. And we looked at White House trade officials above the assistant level all the way up to the U.S. Trade Representative itself, who's a cabinet official for any president. And we looked at really about 20, 25 years of that, both both parties and all that. And we noticed that 47% of the White House trade officials went to work for foreign governments or foreign corporations trying to beat, I guess you'd say, U.S. corporations and U.S. and get access to the U.S. And all of them had made massive amounts of additional money than their salaries, but almost in a way that was borderline obscene. And so I had a news conference at the National Press Club, first time I ever did that, and released the thing, and there were 35 people there. It made news all over the world, and I also had a consulting contract with ABC News where I had used to work, and they wanted to peek at what we were doing prior and then plan coverage if they were interested. But they also couldn't scoop at everyone else. They had to just be ready to report it when I released it if they wanted to do that. And they did a 2020 big, long segment that, you know, I interviewed me and I told it why it's outrageous, and I mentioned some of the big names who had cashed in. That was the first report. And 4 presidential candidates, including Bill Clinton and Ross Perot, and 2 others all said that this was a serious issue in America. And in the first day or first few days of his presidency, Bill Clinton in 93 did an executive order making it basically illegal for White House trade officials from that office, U.S. Trade Representative's office, to go to work for a foreign government or foreign corporation against the U.S., to be a foreign agent, in other words. So that was what the reaction was. It worked out well, and there was a criminal investigation launched at Justice because we had 14 or 15, I think that's a number, something like that, of trade officials who had, one guy was working for Iraq around the time the USS Stark was sunk and 37 Americans, and we had a guy who was working for Iraq helping them. So that, there were things that people had, no one reads records, and we actually had the records, and we thought it was peculiar, to put it charitably.
And so I just want people to get a sense of what that is. And since then, one of the other big things you've done, and we're not going to have time to go into it, is taken some of the investigations you did on the national federal level and began to do them on state levels, looking at, right, at the kind of corruption that goes on, and the revolving doors and so on, lobbyists and staff people and all of that. And it now, in the book you can read more sort of these juicy stories of lots of hours of dull, looking at records ends up having a big bang. You've since been involved with, and I just want so that we cover this topic before we move on, 3 other that I believe are nonprofits: the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, Global Integrity, and the Fund for Independence in Journalism. Can you tell people just what those are and sort of flesh out that nonprofit world that you're involved in?
Sure. We were sued by Russian billionaire oligarchs for a story about George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and Halliburton getting the most contracts in the Iraq War. And so we were sued by Russian billionaire oligarchs. It went on as the biggest libel case in the U.S. in a quarter century, and they hired Akin Gump, a very famous, very large, wealthy law firm. So this was like a David and Goliath moment. And we were asked by the lawyers suing us before they sued, would we like to take it off the website? And we said, no, thank you. And so they sued us. And it went on for 5 years, 150,000 plus discovery documents, 20 people in depositions, including me, for 2 full days. And it got dismissed, and it had been assigned to a judge appointed by George W. Bush. But, of course, it was a little bit of a scary moment there for 5 years. So the Fund for Independence in Journalism was set up as a backstop to protect the center should something happen. And it's like those Star Trek movies where there's an escape vehicle.
Yeah.
If I could move the whole staff over to the fund if the center went down because of some bad ruling by a particular judge or something. So that's what the fund.
But does it also help? In other words, you can spend all of your resources doing the investigative journalism, publishing and promoting the investigative journalism. Then you get hit with a lawsuit, and now you need, I mean,
right.
5 years of lawyers is a lot of money. Does the fund also help with that?
Well, it did. I mean, it's sort of kind of dormant at the moment over the years since all that. But there were three lawsuits against us.
Yeah.
We had 15 to 20 legal threats.
I mean,
serious, like letters. And actual lawsuits ended up being three. They were all dismissed pretty close to the time I left in at the end of 2004. The Russian case when it was dismissed a year later in 2005. So we would say mission accomplished for that fund. I mean,
Okay.
It still
so
can be utilized.
Let's look then at the other two, the international ones, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists and Global Integrity. What are they?
Sure. Well, I mean, you can imagine, I'm incredibly proud of the International Consortium in particular, given, you know, they just did the Panama Papers and the Paradise Papers. But I had this strange notion, my first international investigative reporting conference. I've been going to these types of conferences for, close to 35 to 40 years.
Yeah.
And the first one I ever went to outside the U.S. was in Moscow at the time the attempted coup against Yeltsin had just happened, a very dramatic time in world history. And Carl Bernstein, my old boss, was the keynote speaker. And, you know, I saw journalists pummeled and gunshots in bars I was in. I mean, it was a wild time over there. But I came to see that all these journalists were great, great journalists. And a lot of them were courageous freelancers. And I thought, and then one of the journalists stood up and said, how come I don't have enough money to fly around the world and do the kinds of stories we need to do? Why can't I send an email to somebody in Sri Lanka and say, help me out? And I realized an epiphany. I knew that if no one was going to do that, the New York Times, the Washington Post, all these aggressive, some would say arrogant news organizations would never stand for collaborating with other people because it's not in their DNA. And then I thought, I got really excited, even though I had like three or four employees. I thought, if there could be a construct that could be like a safe place for all the good, great journalists to do cool stuff across borders and oceans, what if you could get the Jedi Knights of planet Earth, the best journalists, to do projects that transcend nation states, that are just really important, extremely important, but in fact are undercovered because they're too complex and there are too many elements because it's international. So that was the idea. It took 5 years for me to get the money. The idea occurred in 92. 97, I hired a war reporter, Maude Bielman, spectacular journalist, to run it. And, you know, the rest is history. They've done 20 or 21 international investigations. The largest one, 13.4 million records, is the Paradise Papers. And I know that the Panama Papers right before that had 400 people working on these projects, 100-plus news organizations, 76 countries, all six continents, doing coverage about a single topic, and also going down in the weeds about individual companies in their respective countries. But so it's pretty exciting, and that's actually one of my proudest things ever, because I hoped it would work. I knew the Internet had started up. There was emails, and there were starting to be platforms, and But I also knew that journalists were too competitive and they would never do it with each other voluntarily.
Right, right. Yeah. Because that scoop culture, right?
Yeah, so I thought, well, I'll do something where they think it's all a cool idea, but they will feel that it maybe doesn't offend their competitive sensibilities.
Yeah.
And there was a way to do that. The New York Times and Washington Post were the last to really decide they would join up and participate. But when they started getting scooped and everyone else is talking about it, they started to realize that maybe they should participate as well, which, of course, was a wonderful moment for me to savor, I'll confess.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, when they joined the club you started.
Yeah, I didn't say anything, but I enjoyed the moment, shall we say.
So what we've talked about is we're about the halfway point. We've talked about your path. We've talked about the role of nonprofits, which I think is one of your threads of hope and collaboration is another. And so both of those things, as we've pointed out, nonprofits because commercial interferes with information and truth, and then collaboration because the competitive nature doesn't serve us at a certain point. So these are threads for the future. Let me just tell people, this is Freeform, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with Charles Lewis. He's the founding director of the Center for Public Integrity. His last book was 935 Lies, The Future of Truth and the Decline of America's Moral Integrity, published at least a year before Donald Trump descended that escalator. And you can learn more at charles-lewis.com, charles-lewis.com, and publicintegrity.org. So, what we won't have time to deal with is all the sort of the history of lies that, as I pointed out in the intro, 935 lies by the Bush-Cheney administration in the 2 years following September 11th to justify the war in Iraq, but pales in comparison to what is happening now under Trump. But I want to go back to a moment that you mention in the book, which is the moment that leads Carl Bernstein to say, "We have seen the triumph of idiot culture." February 11th, 1990.
Yeah. It's a magnificent. He basically tells this great story, and there's a great site also people might like called investigatingpower.org,
okay,
where I interviewed 27 iconic journalists, Carl being one of them, and he talks about the idiot culture on video. People, and he also, this started with an article, I think, in the New Republic, and he was struck the same day that, approximately the same day, the Berlin Wall came down, the same day that Nelson Mandela is being released from prison after 26 years. ABC News's number one story is to interview Donald Trump's soon-to-be ex-wife, which led the show. So Diane Sawyer was not sent to South Africa to see the gates open and Mandela come out. She was not sent to Berlin. She was sent to go interview, I think, Marla Maples.
Yep.
That's what made Carl say, triumph of the idiot culture, which I happen to think, I've told him, I think it might be one of the best things he ever wrote, maybe in his life, because he nailed it. And this is 1992 we're talking.
Yeah, no, what I think is, I think 1990. I think it's 1990.
Year 90, yeah. But this is scary how far back it was, because we haven't exactly progressed much.
And the fact that it's Trump. I mean, that's the
yeah,
sort of the...
That most important, yeah.
The poetic horror of it all.
Yeah,
is
true.
That we, you know, is that we, where we sit today? So, something that lies at the core of this book and lies at the core of this conversation is that the national commitment to integrity has been eroded. Commercial journalism has lost some of what, you know, what seems essential to a democracy. Briefly, what do you think? You know, what are the things that led to that?
There's so many things. The owners for the newspapers, which is our most substantive news source compared to, say, television, I think it's fair to say. And so basically what happened is the newspaper owners were greedy, and they kept a lot of the money. They didn't reinvest in new technologies. They didn't remotely seem to understand this new thing called the Internet, the World Wide Web, and how technology and information would all change the world. And they basically were flat-footed, and, you know, we've lost 15,000 to 20,000 commercial journalists. We have the same number of reporters today now because of the carnage that we had in 1972, the year of the Watergate break-in. The problem is we added 100 million people, and the federal budget has gone up 18 times. A lot of cities all over America have half as many reporters. 27 states have no one covering their members of Congress in Washington. One-third fewer foreign journalists covering the world. Oh, by the way, the world. And all of that's because of the greed and stupidity and lack of vision, frankly, of the owners of the conventional commercial journalism world, particularly, well, especially newspapers, because that is the most substantive news source generally. Television did similar things. the dumbing down of the shows, of the news shows themselves. Even if you look at any local news, you get the traffic accidents, occasional murder. You'll get a few headlines here and there, traffic. And for ratings, you'll have teenage, prostitutes walking around with secret cameras. And you will not have a politician or anyone in public affairs, you know, government talking about anything because they want them to buy ads because they'll make a lot more money. The TV stations make $1 to $2 billion a year every election cycle because the candidates have to buy ads because they don't have free airtime to talk about what they stand for.
That's right. Let me just emphasize that for people. You know, we notice, of course, and we all hate the enormous number of ads that run. But I don't think I'd quite put it together that the reason they don't cover them is that it then means the only way you get on is to buy an ad. And basically, what I have said for years is that it's kind of a flow through. You have wealthy corporate donors in the main putting millions of dollars directly to TV stations for ads. It never touches the citizenry. It never informs. It's just most of the money that is raised goes straight through this funnel. And you actually pay more for ads during campaigns because the real estate becomes more scarce.
That's right. And you're talking, the American public gets bombarded with all these ads, so many of them negative, that I think the last two presidential elections had something in the neighborhood of 2 to 3 million ads, commercials. It makes people weary and wary of all that stuff, and it tunes people tune out. And, you know, we are notorious for the lack of participation
in
politics in general. It doesn't exactly help that.
And one of the things that people, again, may not quite have connected all the dots, Citizens United unleashed this enormous amount of wealthy and corporate money. But it turns out that much of it is not, quote, coordinated with the campaign. It's those extra campaign groups, and they cannot endorse their candidate. So what you then do is you do negative. So that it isn't just that there's more money, it's that that money is almost all going to negative ads, which you are allowed to do. You can slam the other person all you want, but you can't promote your own candidate.
No, that's right. And you have outside groups now that will wage a campaign against a candidate based on their questionnaire that they fill out before they become candidates or as they're just joining the world of politics. And if they answer incorrectly, they won't get any money, and they might get hit ads against them. And if they answer correctly, they'll get a lot of money and maybe win. That's how things work here. And usually the candidate who gets the most money wins. That's generally the case. It's not always every minute the case, but that's pretty much the case. And so you have a system where half of members of Congress, more than half now, are millionaires. 5% of America or less are millionaires. So we've skewed our whole political system and process, and it's directly related to what's happened with the cost of campaigning and communicating to the public by would-be politicians. The whole thing is warped and distorted. And then you have a disclosure issue, of course. You have these 501c4 organizations, these secret, creepy folks who you have no idea who the hell they are. You have groups like the Chamber of Commerce, a 501c6 type tax designation. They spent in 1 2-year cycle $1 billion to try to get their way with corporate influence in various ways across the country. And so, there's all this activity going on, and the public is a mere bystander in all this. Most Americans don't really know or want to know for understandable reasons about any of this because it's so sordid and depressing. But essentially, we've had our political process somewhat altered and even taken from us in many ways by these very, very powerful interests. And so this is a problem. It's been a problem for years. I always looked at money in politics. We did 3 Buying of the President books, a Buying of the Congress book. But I'm basically an investigative reporter, a muckraker. My job is not to tell people which way to vote or what bill to endorse, or I've always seen myself as my job is to be a watchdog type and not to tell people what they should do. There's plenty of advocacy groups that do that, and in many cases do it well. It's just my job has always been to try to stick to the attempted truth-telling, I guess
you'd
call it. Yeah,
just sunshine. I mean, you even point out that at that point, in that turning point in your life, when you left 60 Minutes, you did not choose a cause to become the reporter on. You chose kind of the broad canvas of wrongs and hypocrisy. I'm going to read a couple of quotes here. If the press had been doing its job during the 2016 campaign rather than chasing revenues, this is a continuation of the conversation we're just having, Trump might well not be president today. And then of the nonstop, uncritical coverage of Trump speeches, Leslie Moonves, chief executive of CBS, the network you used to work for, the network that produces 60 Minutes, mm-hmm. famously said on the record, it may not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS. So you actually believe, and I think many people do, that Trump's free ride from the start of from when he announced his candidacy until very late in the primary season gave him an advantage that no one could match.
Well, I believe it because I think it's pretty clear that that's the case. I mean, this is a guy who was in primetime television, reality TV, whatever you want to call it, for 16 years. So he was already a pretty extremely well-known celebrity. And then you have what has been estimated, and this is in an article I recently wrote, $5.8 billion, that's with a B, of free airtime that was given to him just because he was such a character and there was just such elaborate and extensive coverage because he would always dominate every debate. Certain channels, obviously Fox and others, would have very positive but also extensive coverage of him. That's 35 to 40 million. I don't know how many million, but it's lots of people, a big segment.
And they would just run his rallies and speeches as entertainment.
Yeah, no, exactly. And he would always say almost the standby outrageous thing for the day, whether
mm-hmm.
it was,
yep.
you know, offended people on a, you know, racial equality level or any other level, he would say things and do things that he, you know, were bombastic, but always would make people scratch their heads and pay attention to him. He was very good at getting attention for himself. And when you get that level of free coverage, essentially, it's unprecedented in the amount of free coverage he got. No other candidate in U.S. history ever got that level of free media.
Right. And so here's another thing you say, and it ties these last two strands together. If the media-enabled rise of the habitually dishonest, manifestly unqualified Donald Trump to the Oval Office proves anything, it's that you get what you pay for in life. Pay nothing for journalism, and that's the kind of journalism you'll get. And I think that really explains a great deal of his rise, his momentum, and his eventual victory. One thing we're not going to talk about because we don't have time, because I want to talk now in a moment here about the current situation with Trump and the future. But one thing that is in your book and one thing that is equally important, and as you point out, has probably cost more U.S. lives than the lives of the government, is corporate lying. I'll just give you know, like a moment to sort of check in on that one.
Well, yeah, the book has real-time truth charts about corporate lying and government lying, the most egregious moments that seem at least most egregious to me over half a century. The number of people in the 20th century who died of smoking is estimated by the World Health Organization to be 100 million people. The number that will die this century will be 1 billion people. That's a case of something that was known for 60 years by the tobacco industry to cause cancer and to be, you know, extremely detrimental, as in fatal, to millions of people. And they consistently, aggressively lied about it. And their whole strategy was to create doubt that maybe it wasn't true, and they were going to investigate it if there was a problem, of course, and they kept kicking the can down the road. And anyway, the media was very supportive of the tobacco industry, took in $12 to $13 billion in newspaper and magazine ads from 1970, when TV was banned using tobacco ads, all the way till 2000, six or so. So they, basically, they threw their money around, they got their way, and had massive consequences. And frankly, if you add up all of these things that we're talking about just with the corporations, the number of people the carnage is just astonishing, yeah. Jaw-dropping.
Yeah, when you add
it's all about lies.
Ethyl and gasoline, the lead in paint, again, yeah. Something they knew about for many, many years and fought, and et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, so that's in there, too, and that's another thing where we're in trouble. So let's, for the last 8 minutes or so, you say, as alarming as Trump's lying and the media's failure to counter it are, the real challenge confronting American democracy is a deeper one. And what is that challenge?
Well, I think that the deeper one is, I actually feel that we've lost control and a grip, really, about our democracy itself. I mean, we're almost an innocent bystander in our own, the play that is our life, but most Americans are not participating in it. They're kind of astonished by it. There's a substantial amount of ignorance about it, or they don't choose to believe certain things. You have 35% who don't think Donald Trump has a problem with lying, for example, which I find terrifying, actually.
Yeah, yeah. And
so when you put that all together, people now, we're in a moment now in our own history where people seem to believe what they want to believe, which is dangerous as hell. And I think there's no question in my mind, this is the scariest moment in my life because I don't know how this movie ends.
Mm-hmm. And let me ask you this. It seems to me that if we look at young people at Parkland calling BS, the calling out of Bill Cosby, Harvey Weinstein, Me Too, the number of powerful people in certain fields that have been taken down by their past behavior and so on. It seems to me there is something bubbling up as a counter to this. It seems to me that the public is, certain truths are getting through that weren't getting through.
No, it's true, and you know, I'm not an expert on political change, but from what reading I've done over the years, the only time change ever occurred, and this includes the civil rights movement and laws changing on that, it was young people, folks in their teens and 20s who are mad as hell, and they think it's unbelievably outrageous, and they want it to change, and they are become the engine of change. It's not older folks who do that. It's usually the younger folks just becoming adults or newly arrived adults who have energy, anger, and they're not tethered as deeply to the mores or the I guess you'd call it the restraints or habits of the past.
And yeah, so, I think part of it, and if you even think about your own career, you were fairly young when you made some of your more courageous decisions. I think it's that you haven't become habituated. You haven't become comfortable yet.
Or dependent on.
Or dependent. On yes, you've got a family.
Yeah, you might not like your job, but you'll deal with it. You know, I know there are a lot of people that do that later in life. But when you're starting out, you still have some idealism, which is really important, I think. It's necessary, in fact.
Yeah, which is one of the reasons I think the other thing which plays into this is student debt. Which ends up saddling young, courageous people who might be questioning with the kinds of constraints that usually you didn't get until you had your house and your first couple of kids.
Well, that's right. And, you know, here I am, a university professor, but I'm going to say this. It's pretty clear. I know of cases where universities have banded together and collectively decided to raise tuition as a group. There was going to be congressional hearings on it, and the senator involved got 10 presidents of universities coming to his office from his particular state. And funny thing, those hearings never happened, and all the investigative material that had been gathered by his staff suddenly was never published. And so universities, you know, have a financial incentive to keep raising the tuitions. And they do, and a lot of regular folks can't afford it, and then you have this whole industry that hopes to make and does make millions and millions or more dollars from student debt and you have folks saddled for decades. And that has a way of anyone who has student debt to that extent is kind of bogged down already. They're not going to be a real idealistic about anything because they're frustrated as hell about all the debt they encountered. So that's unfortunate, and it's one of many problems we all have. But that's not right.
Yeah, and do you sense that? And I think we've mentioned it once that actually, Trump, the election of Trump, the disregard for the truth he has, the carelessness and so on, has actually finally begun to turn something around. Do you think some things have gotten better?
I do like the idea that the public feels. I feel like much of the public is waking up a little bit. They're starting to realize this is, even by American standards, this is downright peculiar. And it's not only peculiar, it's outrageous and embarrassing, especially for anyone who travels outside the U.S. And I realize only 30 or 35% of Americans have passports, but when you go around the world, and I go around the world a lot, I am stunned and embarrassed. You really find yourself embarrassed. You're in other countries, and they look at you like, what the hell happened to you guys? My God. And they say variations of that. And you feel like someone died, and it's not a person. It doesn't seem like the U.S. of A. that they have always admired. You know what I mean? You can feel the depression almost about
yeah.
it, because they are now, of course, being affected by it themselves in varying ways, many countries. But it's really the U.S., like it or not, has always had this reputation for being a little bit of an ideal democracy, city on the hill, all the cliches. But, you know, the U.S. was always seen as a special place with special values and freedoms and pretty high quality for the most part. Off and on, it varied, but quality governance and structures and the Constitution, a very strong, livable Constitution that's endured over 200 years, which is unusual by global standards. And now they're looking at this and they're saying, what the hell happened there?
Yeah.
And they're fascinated and alarmed.
Yeah, and now as we who've been looking at this, you know, we see the erosion, you know, we see the change in information people have. We see the negativity that creates cynicism, which means that actually the people deciding things gets less and less. We see it. But for many of them, I imagine the election, well, the invasion of Iraq probably, was quite
a... started it down the track there.
Exactly. When they began to see, whoops, something's gone wrong over there. So if I give you 1 minute, Charles Lewis, what should listeners do? What should they read? How do we deal with this?
Well, I mean, I think the best thing to do, and I'm sure your listeners all do this already, so I don't want to be redundant, but being on top of the news, I mean, we have a full-scale drama here. We have the beginnings of what might end up becoming a constitutional crisis. This is deja vu all over again when we think back to Watergate and things like that. You have 17 indictments already. You're going to have many more coming. We are in for a very bizarre, extraordinary, historically unique moment in our history in the coming 12 to 18 months, not to mention the midterm elections and also the later election after that, the presidential coming up. So this country is in a moment. It's in a massive turmoil at the moment, but it's also at use a cliche there, but it's a moment of truth for the nation and the public. And so, being involved, I'm sure your listeners are already highly literate and are following things very closely. The New York Times, the Washington Post are doing a pretty exceptional job of tracking all things Trump lately, including 24/7 teams and special investigative SWAT teams. And there's all kinds of special attempts at really telling every little thing about it, to the point of almost you can actually OD on some of that if you're not careful.
Yeah,
but the bottom line is we're at a very, very crucial moment. It's not unlike the period of 72 to 74. That does not mean necessarily we can say what the outcome is.
That's right.
But this is a moment that we'll never forget as long as we live.
Yeah. And so it's stay informed and then stay involved. Don't let the cynicism or the resignation take it away. So Again, the websites are charles-lewis.com and publicintegrity.org. And that other one you mentioned, which people will probably, investigatingpower.com.
.org.
Yeah. Investigatingpower.org. And the his latest book is 935 Lies, A Future of Truth and the Decline of America's Moral Integrity. Thank you, Charles Lewis. Keep up the good work.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Okay. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and joining me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements of who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 5, 6, 7 relevant articles for that week, you can sign up at my site, or you can email me at T.E. McNally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y @mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to Freeform Podcast on iTunes. And you can find years of podcasts at my site and at iTunes. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, etc., etc. Thanks to G, my engineer, Mark Maxwell in production, and George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices. And most of all, to you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely.